up is the news.
The headlines: under heavy guard, the U.S. Congress resumes its work to certify the electoral votes for President-elect Joe Biden after a violent pro-Trump mob stormed Capitol Hill. Four people die amid chaotic scenes inside U.S. Capitol Hill after pro-Trump rioters storm the building in a stunning bid to overturn his election defeat. And the chief of staff of Iran's armed forces says Israel's assassination of nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh will definitely be avenged at a proper time and place. Hello and welcome, everybody. The U.S. Congress has resumed the process of certifying Electoral College votes after it went into recess when supporters of President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol building. The House and the Senate rejected two objections from Trump allies to overturn Joe Biden's victories in Arizona and Pennsylvania. The two chambers will hold a joint session next to continue the ratification process. Only 12 Electoral College votes were counted before the session was interrupted by pro-Trump rioters. The certification process is usually a short ceremonial event, but objections by Republicans could delay the process. Their 538 electoral votes, Biden secured 306 votes in the November presidential election, more than 270 needed to get a majority. U.S. police say at least four people were killed after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump stormed Capitol Hill to prevent the certification of Electoral College votes for President-elect Joe Biden. According to the D.C. police, one woman succumbed to injuries after being shot by law enforcers. They say three other protesters died in medical emergencies. At least 52 people have so far been arrested. The D.C. police also say they've recovered two pipe bombs as the headquarters of Republican and Democratic national committees. The unprecedented violence prompted Washington's mayor to extend the public emergency to 15 days until Biden's inauguration. Coinciding with riots on the Capitol building, pro-Trump protest rallies were held at state houses in several cities, including Los Angeles. Riot police made a number of arrests after the gathering outside L.A. City Hall turned violent. Sporadic clashes also broke out between Trump supporters and Black Lives Matter protesters. There, a similar rally in the city of Salem, Massachusetts, turned violent. In the capital of Oregon, pro-Trump protesters burned an effigy of the state's Democratic governor. At least one person was arrested. In Kansas, protesters entered the state house in Topeka and assembled on the first floor. Several government buildings in Denver and Atlanta were ordered closed due to protests near their state houses. Rallies were also held in a number of other state capitals, among them Little Rock, Tallahassee, and Santa Fe. Political analyst Jack Rasmus says there are strong indications police and the National Guard in Washington, D.C. were in collusion with Trump as they failed to stop the unruly mob.
So there is a question, you know, why didn't 1,000 Capitol Police just do nothing? And why didn't D.C. police come around for at least 6 hours? You know, there were hours before they even got any help from anybody. So it was all very, very curious affair, you know. And I heard that Nancy Pelosi had talked with the chief of the Capitol Police, and he assured them. Assured her that no one would even get on the steps of the Capitol if they came, because, you know, we knew this was going to happen. We knew there were going to be demonstrations there. But, you know, I think the Capitol Police let it get out of hand, and someone needs to answer for that. And it wouldn't have happened to the extent it did. But, you know, it backfired, as I said. It backfired on them, and now they're in even deeper trouble than they were in the very beginning here. And it's going to be interesting to see what Trump does in the next 72 hours, because he's really under attack now from the rest of the political elite that have closed ranks against him. And he may not make it to January 20th.
Former U.S. presidents have denounced the rioting by Donald Trump supporters on the Capitol building in a statement. Former President Barack Obama described the attack as a moment of great dishonor and shame for America. Obama accused Trump of lying about the outcome of a lawful election. Former Republican President George W. Bush also drew a comparison between the incident and how election results are disputed in, quote, a banana republic. President-elect Joe Biden also denounced the storming, calling for an end to the chaos.
This is not dissent. It's disorder. It's chaos. It borders on sedition. And it must end now.
Biden also described the storming as an assault on U.S. democracy. 42nd President Bill Clinton condemned what he called an unprecedented assault, blaming Trump for fueling riots. Jimmy Carter, the 39th American president, slammed the raid as a national tragedy. He called for a peaceful resolution that can help complete the transfer of power. Several lawmakers from both parties have also denounced the current president for what they called inciting a coup. Top officials from around the world have also condemned the storming of the U.S. Congress building by pro-Trump supporters. Let's take a listen.
In the eyes of the world, American democracy tonight appears under siege. This is an unseen assault on the U.S. democracy, its institutions, and the rule of law. This is not America. The election results of the 3rd of November must be fully respected.
Disgraceful scenes in U.S. Congress. The United States stands for democracy around the world, and it is now vital that there should be a peaceful and orderly transfer of power.
The violent acts against American institutions are a grave attack against democracy. I condemn them. The American people's will and vote must be respected.
Iran has once again pledged to avenge the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was killed in a terror attack in November. Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Mohammad Bagheri, said Iran will retaliate at the proper time and place. He underlined that the U.S. and Israeli regimes were plotting to assassinate Fakhrizadeh for 2 decades. Bagheri made the comments during a ceremony marking the 40th day of the martyrdom of Fakhrizadeh. He hailed the character, knowledge, and dedication of the slain scientist. The general noted that the country's youth would continue his legacy in the path of progress. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a terrorist attack near Tehran. He was deputy defense minister and head of the ministry's Organization for Defensive Innovation and Research. Senior editor at UWI Analytical Center, Alexander Ozadegan, joins us now from Irvine, California. Mr. Ozadegan, welcome to the program. Please give us your perspective on the recent comments made by Iran's chief of staff of the armed forces with regards to the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, in his words, by the Israelis.
It's good to be with you, Bardi, and our global audience. I watched the speech in Persian, and I found it profoundly inclusive of some of the options that Tehran may take. The worst thing that Iran could do is do nothing. I think the enemies of Iran are banking on that because they feel they have cornered Iran into such a vicious place that if Iran reacts, it's going to be punished. If it doesn't react, it's going to make itself prone to future attacks like this. I think at the heart of this is to bring Iran back into what they call the negotiation table. I think policymakers in Brussels, and it's not just in Washington, in Brussels as well, they need to realize there will be no negotiations needed to restore the Iranian nuclear deal. Washington, under whatever president, can't just come in and go into international treaties and expect the world to hold its breath. Negotiations were over in July of 2015. Iran should not negotiate over the same real estate twice, as your foreign minister has been saying repeatedly since 2018. And besides, negotiations were over Iran's nuclear issue, not over Iran's foreign policy. in the region or outside the region, or Iran's deterrent missile program, or any other issue other than the nuclear issues. This was explicitly stated. Washington cannot just continuously move the goalpost, and that in and out of itself is a form of violation and reneging. So it's the assassination of Professor Fakhrizadeh, the assassination of General Soleimani, which, by the way, if we mention General Soleimani in our social medias, they block us for 30 days. I just got blocked on Facebook and Instagram for that. This is absolutely ridiculous. They cannot just go unanswered. I think Iran has to be very even-handed. Let me know anytime if you want to interrupt with a follow-up question.
No, it's okay. Please continue.
Okay. Yeah, it has to go through legal channels. I think your judiciary system, just a few days ago, trying to push for an arrest of Donald Trump was extremely, when it comes to the symbolic perspective, when it comes to the PR perspective, in my opinion, is very successful. Trying, going after this man, even though it may not necessarily go anywhere. As far as some European dignitaries, even at the UN level, which made some very interesting statements about how illegal it was, the killing of General Soleimani was completely extrajudicial. And also, you tie that with Professor Fakhrizadeh. If you actually manage to gather enough global momentum through the legal channels, yes, it doesn't hold as much luster as it would do in the battlefield, which, again, is an option for the Iranians, as it should be. This was the assassination of a military figure. And certainly retaliating in such a limited way of missile attacks against Ain al-Assad base in Al-Anbar province, in my opinion, that's not enough. If that was enough, you wouldn't be having B-52s probably equipped with nuclear war, missiles. We don't know if that nuclear bombs on it or not. They wouldn't be parading over the Iranian airspace in the Persian Gulf, and they would, they just passed this. They came up with the decision not to pull USS Nimitz out of the Persian Gulf based on some ridiculous audio recording that Iran is going to attack the Capitol building, our Congress. I mean, this is ridiculous. They want Iran to fully attack in a military way. I think Iran's measure should be even-handed. It should go through legal channels. Like I said, it doesn't hold as much luster, but they're actually petrified of that, even though international law hasn't exactly existed under Donald Trump. They want to move into a rule-based system, and guess who sets the rules? Washington does. So with Biden and the neoliberals coming back to power, these people seem to have more respect for global institutions, for international law, and that's exactly where Iran should head, where it heads them, from an international law perspective. But there were some talks about revenging Professor Fakhrizadeh by getting a Mossad high command individual. That certainly would be an option. Iran increasing its presence in Syria, which, by the way, the Israeli Air Force has been bombarding with their F-16, especially the T-4 base, the Syrian T-4 base, I mean, almost without any restraint in the past several months. From what I know about your culture and the Iranian foreign policy is that they will let their enemies get as close to them as possible, and then they will hit. And when they hit, it will hurt. We certainly hope our counterparts in Tehran, the reformist counterparts, would maintain that policy, because it's a national interest issue. It's not just internal Iranian political issue. And we hope they stay true to that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Alexander Ozadegan, joining us from Irvine, California. Elsewhere, residents of Syrian capital's countryside have come together to commemorate the first martyrdom anniversary of Iranian top commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq last year. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali has more in this report.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat, and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country.
We have gathered here to honor the memory of Commander Soleimani, who offered Syria valuable services. General Soleimani is a historic hero whose achievements changed the region.
A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Syrian Air Defense Forces have repelled an act of Israeli aggression in the south of the country. A Syrian military spokesman said missiles flying over the Golan Heights targeted several locations in the southern areas of Damascus. Syrian forces fired surface-to-air missiles toward intercepted the missiles. This is the third such attack in nearly 10 days. Last month, Israel launched a similar attack on Damascus, killing a soldier and three others. The recent upsurge in the number of Israeli attacks is seen as a reaction to the Syrian forces' success in battling foreign-backed terror groups seeking to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad. The Yemeni Petroleum Company has slammed Saudi Arabia and its allies for the blockade. In a press conference, it says the siege is causing the company millions of dollars and has led to the deaths of innocent civilians. More details from our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali.
The executive director of Yemen's petroleum company has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a over Saudi Arabia's blockade. The officials say the company lost over $100 million in 2020 due to the Saudi-led coalition violations and siege, and accused the UN of complicity.
The United Nations is providing cover for the Saudi-led coalition's acts of piracy in international waters, and it bears full responsibility for them. The violations are huge, and the fines we have suffered are immense.
The senior official said nearly two dozen petrol ships belonging to Yemen's petroleum company were confiscated by Saudi Arabia in 2020. He said the seizures came despite the fact that the ships all had transit permits from the UN. Yemen's petroleum company said the ships were released after a few months, but Saudi Arabia's quota acts of piracy cost them millions of dollars in delay fines.
The United Nations has become a clear partner in this blockade against the Yemeni people and has come to stand by the coalition of aggression, so it bears responsibility for the humanitarian crisis.
Yemeni officials say the confiscation of ships caused a spike in fuel prices and forced the closure of some services. They also say the delays and lack of fuel pushed the medical sector to collapse and caused a humanitarian crisis. Many people have to wait for days to get fuel for their vehicle and the limited number of petrol stations.
Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen has led to the deaths of Yemeni people and is pushing the country further toward what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has taken place amid the silence of international organizations. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Well, that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
According to a new study published in Communications Earth and Environment, the largest inland body of water on Earth, the Caspian Sea, is on a particularly precipitous decline. Scientists are now warning this salty body of water will fall between 9 and 18 meters, 30 and 59 feet, by the end of the century. If emissions continue to rise, a decline of that magnitude would evaporate nearly the entire northern Caspian Shelf and some of the Turkmen Shelf to the southeast. Researchers say the eastern margin would be completely desiccated. In the worst-case scenario of an 18-meter drop in sea level, models show 34% of this sea surface area will shrink. And yet, this enormous crisis is still thoroughly underappreciated by the public. Even the scientific community is largely unaware of what's going on. The International Panel on Climate Change has not addressed lake evaporation from climate change in any of its reports, nor has the United Nations addressed the issue in its Sustainable Development Goals. If nothing is done, the consequences to the environment will be immense. The projected decline in sea level will severely impact this unique ecosystem, and the loss of shallow water in the south will deprive endemic fish, birds, and seals of invaluable habitats, spawning grounds, and food sources. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Carly Casella under the heading, "It May Be Too Late to Save the World's Largest Lake from Climate Change." This article has appeared on the front page of thesciencealert.com. Please stay tuned. Most people know the world's oceans are on the rise. But further inland, the scales of climate change are tipping in the exact opposite direction. As melting glaciers feed fresh water on the oceans, heat and drought are draining our lakes and inland seas of precious liquid. According to a new study published in Communications Earth and Environment, the largest inland body of water on Earth, the Caspian Sea, is on a particularly precipitous decline. Scientists are now warning this salty body of water will fall between 9 and 18 meters, 30 and 59 feet, by the end of the century, if emissions continue to rise. A decline of that magnitude would evaporate nearly the entire northern Caspian Shelf and some of the Turkmen Shelf to the southeast. Researchers say the eastern margin would be completely desiccated. In the worst-case scenario of an 18-meter drop in sea level, models show 34% of this sea surface area will shrink. And yet, this enormous crisis is still thoroughly underappreciated by the public. Even the scientific community is largely unaware of what's going on. The International Panel on Climate Change has not addressed lake evaporation from climate change in any of its reports, nor has the United Nations addressed the issue in its Sustainable Development Goals. The authors of the new paper write, "The impacts of the overlooked facet of future sea level change, falling levels of lakes and seas in the continental interiors on a global scale, could be similarly devastating as global sea level rise and threaten the livelihood of millions of people worldwide." Due to its size, about 371,000 square kilometers, that is about 143,000 square miles, and its salinity levels of around 1.2%, the Caspian was deemed a sea instead of a lake. Without immediate and coordinated action, the Caspian Sea will serve as a poster child for receding lakes in a rapidly warming world. The authors say a global task force is therefore urgently needed. If nothing is done, the consequences to the environment will be immense. The projected decline in sea level will severely impact this unique ecosystem, and the loss of shallow water in the south will deprive endemic fish, birds, and seals of invaluable habitat, spawning grounds and food sources. The new paper concludes, "The expected escalating effects of Caspian Sea decline are likely to lead to a wholesale reorganization of ecosystems and threaten unique Caspian biota that have been evolving in a basin over millions of years. Even those areas of the Caspian Sea already protected will be transformed beyond recognition, as deposits of nutrients bypass these rising shelves to head straight to the central part of the basin. Dead zones will likely emerge as temperatures grow hotter and rivers carry less oxygen to the sea, impacting both the shallowest and deepest waters of the inland sea, similar to what's already happening in some parts of the world's oceans." The geopolitical consequences are also terribly worrisome. Local economies depend on fishing and maritime trade will be affected irrevocably, as will coastal ports, which will suddenly find themselves much further from the water. The loss will also likely exacerbate water scarcity issues in the arid region, no doubt causing international disputes. Experts predict, as the livelihoods and food security of millions of people depend on the Caspian Sea, a loss of these ecosystem services will have drastic socioeconomic consequences and may trigger local and regional conflicts. And this is hardly just a problem for the Caspian Sea. A few recent studies have shown falling water levels in enclosed seas and lake systems, largely due to continental drying from climate change. Because lakes do not have an outflow, they are particularly vulnerable to rising temperatures. Their water level is almost solely determined by precipitation, river inflow, and evaporation. The same is true of the Caspian Sea, which relies on the Volga River for its inflow. Precise models for lake retreat around the world are desperately needed to save these precious ecosystems and the economies and societies they support. Unfortunately, it's too late to save the Caspian through emission cuts alone. Already, the inland body of water is declining at a rate of 6 to 7 centimeters, 2.4 to 2.8 inches each year. Intense regional adaptation and mitigation efforts are therefore desperately needed. Public awareness would be a good place to start. For decades now, the decline of inland lakes has been misunderstood and overlooked even by the experts. The authors wrote, for example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's first assessment report suggested an increase in Caspian Sea level from about 2010 onwards, adding, none of the IPCC Thin Thesis reports considers this issue further. A sheer lack of research is part of the problem. The risks and vulnerability of the Caspian Sea due to water loss have barely been studied at all. Based on the case of the Caspian Sea, the authors are calling for a global campaign to raise awareness and improve research for the world's shrinking lakes and inland seas. They have been neglected for too long. Matthias Prang, who creates climate models at the University of Bremen in Germany, said, many people are not even aware that an inland lake is dramatically shrinking due to climate change, as our models indicate, adding, this has to change. We need more studies and a better understanding of the consequences of global warming in this region.
The debate.
Greetings and a warm welcome to the debate program with me, your host, Behrouz Najafi. Kuwait is speaking of what it calls a breakthrough toward resolving several Arab states' dispute with Qatar. Saudi airspace, land, and sea borders with Qatar are supposed to be open. In 2017, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the UAE, and Bahrain cut their relations with Doha. They issued a steep list of 13 demands for their neighbor to implement or face trade and travel embargoes. Among the conditions were curbing diplomatic ties with Iran, cutting ties with Muslim Brotherhood and Hezbollah, closing the Al Jazeera TV channel, and putting an end to Turkish military presence in Qatar. No such a thing has happened, so what's responsible for this change of heart in the absence of Doha's compliance? Stay with us for a debate on that issue.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it has leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued a policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha, that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens, who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
Well, that was a report by Mehdi Farahman. Now, let me invite author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer from London. Good to have you with us, Jonathan. Beginning with the first question for you, there have been no compliance with the 13 conditions that the four Arab states tried to impose on Qatar. Doha has just accepted not to push ahead with its lawsuits in the case. But you know that the steps are being taken toward mending the ties. What's been responsible for this?
Well, a lot of the responsibility can be really accredited to Kuwait, who has played a very positive role over the last months and indeed years, determined to try to overcome, which was, after all, an absolutely absurd break in between the so-called Arab quartet of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE, and Egypt on the one hand, and Qatar on the other. It's created great difficulty for many individuals who have family on both sides of the divide. It's created all sorts of problems for people traveling, etc. But it's failed. It's been an absurd exercise. And I'm pleased that at the GCC summit today, we saw that basically the Arab quartet has accepted that it was all a waste of time and that they have to now shake hands and make friends.
Okay, thank you for that. And let me also invite political analyst and director of the IGA, Ali Al Ahmed, out of Washington, D.C., and ask his comments as well. Welcome to the show, Ali Al Ahmed. My question for you, the four Arab states severed their relations with Doha over allegations of funding terrorism, and this was also echoed by President Trump. Now, Qatar never accepted the allegations and thus did nothing to appease the other side. Yet we hear Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, trying to reconcile Riyadh and Doha. What's going on?
Well, Trump found in the interest of the United States and his administration is to break up the relationship between the Saudis and the Qataris and sort of divide and conquer approach. And now that this policy continued for 3.5 years, now his policy is bring them together and get paid, because now that he's leaving the office, he's trying to have both Qatar and Saudi Arabia on his good side, because he will need funding. His son-in-law, Kushner, is also looking for billions of dollars of investment for their company. So you are looking at somebody who they're self-serving, and they're conducting U.S. policy based on their self-interest. The U.S. has always been a party that worked on dividing Arab countries and Muslim countries, especially neighbors, because that gives them an opportunity and leverage to raise money, to sell arms, to set up bases. So they would say to Saudi Arabia, Iran is a threat. They would say to Saudi Arabia, Qatar is a threat, and Yemen is a threat. So this way we can sell you weapons, we can help you out. Mm-hmm. And that has been the policy. And that's why it's important for MBS to realize that now that he made this, what I call ceasefire with Qatar, he could do that similar approach to other neighbors, to Yemen, number one, with Iran and Turkey and Syria and Iraq. It would be much more prudent for him to do that. And let's hope the Qataris can explain that to him. He would, Saudi Arabia is facing tremendous economic challenges. And if he opens up with Qatar and there is a resolution to this conflict, Saudi Arabia is set to make great economic deals with Qatar, which has a lot of cash and is able to provide Saudi Arabia with economic opportunities.
I see. Now, Jonathan, why didn't the Trump administration try and mediate between the Saudis and the Qataris sooner? I mean, why is this happening on the last days of Trump's term in office?
Well, I think the whole dispute between the Arab Quartet and Qatar just played into Trump's songbook, basically, because he sees everything in terms of a Saudi-led alliance on one side and Iran on the other. And therefore, he was throwing his eggs completely in the basket of Saudi Arabia and its allies within that very bipolar scenario. And so it really did fit his way of looking at the world. But it's interesting, I think, that all this is happening 2 weeks before the presidency of the United States will change. In just over 2 weeks' time, Joe Biden will become the new president of the United States. And although we don't know in detail what he has in mind, I think we can be sure that there will be several significant changes to Donald Trump's very aggressive policy towards Iran in particular, but disruptive policy in the Middle East in general. So I think we have to see it within that framework. And I suppose also he will claim, President Trump, that is some credit for what's just happened today at Al-Ula, that he will say, well, yes, the Americans really wanted this to happen as well, although, of course, that's not really true. It wasn't the Americans that have brought this about. It was the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, and ultimately the other members of the GCC who realize it's in everybody's interest to work more closely together, which is, after all, what the GCC is meant to be all about.
Yeah, but American delegations are there also to get their credit. Okay, Ali, MBS is saying that this is done and the aim is to achieve security, in his words, and stability in this region. And some analysts argue that this is rather to form a united front against Iran. What's your reading of this?
Well, it could be. I think they are attempting to do that. They have been doing that for the past 40 years, basically. And that was the idea behind establishing the GCC, is to build a block against Iran. I think that's the wrong approach, obviously, because Iran is a neighbor. Iran cannot move, to East Asia or to Northern Europe. It is important for MBS to realize that his own interest lies in having good relationships with his neighbors, and especially Arab and Muslim neighbors. And that is where success lies. This is where economic opportunity, stability is. Stopping the war in Yemen, which has burnt over $100 billion from the Saudi coffers, is a great start for MBS. Now you can see the Arab media and social media welcoming this ceasefire, really, between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. We know that UAE and Bahrain, their rulers are not interested in having a relationship with Qatar at this moment, although they signed. So it's important to make a distinction here. This was not sort of a peace treaty or they didn't sign a deal to restore relationship. This was basically just an announcement for ceasefire. So Qatar, yes, they opened the airspace and land crossings, but that's it. And negotiations might succeed. It might not. It might last 1 week. It might last years. So this is not over yet. But it could provide MBS. I think he is now much more aware of the damage that he did in the past few years to his neighbors and to his country, that he may rethink that his approach. Engagement with his neighbors and ending sort of fighting and war is really in his own interest as a person, and the interest of his the people, obviously, of the region as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jonathan, some observers say that Saudis are trying to seemingly bury the hatchet with Doha. Maybe this is a sign of the Saudi failed policies in Lebanon, in Syria, and Yemen.
Well, certainly, I think that what we're seeing is a shift in Saudi Arabia and in its priorities. But I'm sure this is going to take some time. I agree with your other guest, Ali, that we have to remember that UAE and Bahrain, by their recent actions, have shown, for example, that they are not at all 100% behind normalizing relations with Qatar or indeed with Iran, which is perhaps more relevant. But I think things are moving slowly in the right direction. But what will really help, of course, will be if the Saudis accept the inevitable, which is that the war in Yemen is unsustainable. It is unwinnable. This is a conflict which cannot be solved by military means. And therefore, there has to be some sort of negotiated resolution to this. And what I hope is that they can build on this first step of more GCC unity towards more a positive approach towards the Yemen conflict, because that is really the crux of the situation now.
And Ali, could this also be leading to a form of, jumping in the bandwagon of normalizing ties with Tel Aviv after Saudi Arabia does this with Doha?
I think if there is a peace treaty or restoring of relationship between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, Israel will take a back seat. In fact, it will be hard for Israel. I think UAE is the only one who is keen on getting in bed with the Israelis, but the rest are not so much. So I think it will. I don't think people in Tel Aviv, especially Netanyahu and his ilk, are very happy that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are talking and restoring relationship. Here, there's an important opportunity for the leaders of the GCC to realize that you're called the GCC. You know, GCC plus these six countries has Iraq and Iran. So it may be an opportunity to make that council or create another council that will include these countries, because that area should have some kind of political council and meeting to talk about that country, the resources and the territory of the Persian Gulf. It's really an important.
Yeah, but Ali, you should also remember that the GCC was initially formed, to do something, to take moves against Iran and in defense of the then Saddam regime in Iraq.
I know that, but I'm saying that this is an opportunity to realize, maybe 40 years late, that a new vision should take hold. The Americans talk about Abraham Accord, but I talk about the Muhammad Accord, that relationship between Arabs and Muslim countries that we have paid dearly for this conflict over the past 40 plus years because of ignoring each other and other people and our people. We have lost millions of people and trillions of dollars. I think that this is a message, I would say, that to all the leaders of the region to think it's better for them to talk, or even if they disagree, and try to solve the relationship and conflicts by words, not bombs.
Exactly. And Jonathan, that's what Iran has exactly offered since a couple of years back. And you know, in 2017, the Arab Quartet tried to force Doha to sever relations with Tehran, which of course fell on deaf ears, as you know. Iran instead offered dialogue and said, if there are any source of concern, any problems, let's talk to each other. And Saudi Arabia, what it did was impose embargoes on fellow Arab Qatar. So who's playing a destabilizing role here?
Well, certainly the whole absurd being of the blockade of Qatar was Saudi-led destabilization. But I think the things have changed. And I do share Ali's optimism in the long term. that there could well be a very bright future for the Persian Gulf region if indeed there is willingness on all sides to cooperate economically and perhaps to a degree politically as well. It makes a lot of sense for there to be a wider regional cooperation. And this would actually please a lot of other countries around the world, the Europeans and the Americans, who don't particularly wish to be further involved in the Middle Eastern region. And it would be very positive and I think get rid of a lot of negative energy if that long-term goal is kept in view. But it has to be long-term, and it needs confidence-building measures, both from Tehran and from Riyadh. Understandably, that's going to take time. There are many hurts and many wounds that people have, understandably, but they can be overcome if they realize that it's in everybody's long-term interest to actually get on a regional basis.
Okay. Now, one last question for Ali, and you had your recommendation, Ali, for Arab states and rulers there. Do you see any rapprochement on the horizon between Riyadh and Tehran?
I think it's in their interest. Look, each side can say whatever they want about each other, but at the end of the day, these are two neighbors with huge countries and resources. Both countries and the people would benefit from better relations, from cooperation instead of confrontation. You see a lot of damage because of this confrontation. And without blaming any sides here, it is important that, you know, I blame MBS, obviously, but the idea is we stop blaming and let's start talking in the dialogue. This cooperation will mean jobs, will mean stability, will mean no more bombs exploding anywhere.
Okay.
No more shots being in the region. It's really important that the rulers of the region realize that the nationalists and supremacists in Washington or in London, they want this to continue so they can get their slice, they can sell their arms. But for their own interest as politicians is to have dialogue, cooperation, and strong economic and cultural relationship. It will be better for everybody in Tehran or in Riyadh.
Okay. And Jonathan, if you have any comments in 10-20 seconds only.
Yes, I mean, I think we're entering a new era in regional relations, but it's going to take time. This is not something that's going to happen in a year or even five. It's going to take decades. But let's at least move in the right direction.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments and contribution. Author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer joined us out of London. Political analyst and director of the IGA, Ali Al-Ahmed from Washington, D.C.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
باید فرد زیاد به یاد خدا باشه. طبعا وقتی کسی اینجور باشه، به یاد خدا زیاد باشه، گفتشم
We must remember Allah a lot in our lives. If we do so, then all our sayings and actions are full of divine color. This case is true about all classes of a society and different professions, including artists, poets, writers, and even filmmakers. This is where we can distinguish between a righteous and evil poet and artist. Now, remembrance of Allah is one of the most important topics in Islam. Sometimes we think that remembrance of Allah is only the invocation of His attributes in a remote place when we are alone and lead a solitary life. Or sometimes we think that if we are not among the people and we leave our social duties, we can better focus on our connection with Allah. These considerations are all mistakes. We can remember Allah even if we are busy with our lives and do our social activities. We can remember Allah when we are doing our job, when we study or teach. This means that if we are a shopkeeper, we must remember Allah when doing work. There will be no hoarding in the market that is based on remembrance of Allah. Positive and helpful cooperation among the brothers and sisters in faith is another result of the remembrance of Allah in our life. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Khalav Islam page, for listening to this